Good morning.
Good morning.
This is Lent. Okay. The church goes through a number of seasons throughout the church calendar. And I was reading a short story by a Roman Catholic writer by the name of J.F. Powers. And in this short story, he told the story through the voice of a cat in the local Catholic establishment where all the priests and nuns were living. And the cat observed that this Catholic parish observed the following seasons: baseball, football, Christmas, basketball, and Lent. We're in Lent. Actually, we're in baseball season too, Jay. And basketball, that's right. So we are looking at Lent. What is Lent about? I want to answer this question today once and for all. Okay. I can't do this. Okay. I'm a little bit warm, but I think you did you tie it to my coat, John? No? Okay. All right. Okay. All right. I'm getting warmed up already. Sorry. We are looking at the three classic Lenten disciplines from Matthew 6, 1 to 18. It begins with almsgiving or generosity, and then Jesus moved to prayer and then to fasting. And last week we looked at generosity, and this week fasting, and next week prayer. In our scripture readings this morning, we noticed that the response to realizing God's judgment is on the people of God is to confess and to fast. We learned also in this psalm of Psalm 51 what it means to confess our sins. So Psalm 51 has become the foundation for the history of the church's prayers of confession. And then we see in the gospel story, the narrative, that fasting has become an ordinary routine for the people of God. We learn in our gospel readings, and combined with Matthew chapter 6, that fasting that is not fundamentally a relationship with God is a fasting fail. We get a little sassy and we say that non-fasting, non-God fasting, is dieting or disciplining. That's not what fasting means in the Bible. It is all about our relationship with God. During Lent, we enter into fasting, or some of us enter into fasting, in a variety of ways. Many people identify Lent with abstinence from chocolate. I think that's number one. Alcohol, number two. Movies and Facebook and social media now are all about tied with Twitter and Instagram and all those things. So these are the things people are denying themselves of and see it as fasting. So people have a Facebook fast. I have theological objections to using the word fasting with that, but I'll avoid that for right now, but I'm coming back. So fasting for many during Lent is about abstaining from pleasures and distractions. And quite often one informs others that a fast is being undertaken in order to gain one's spiritual balance again. Spiritual balance, of course, is a very good idea, like Christmas and baseball. But I want to refocus our thoughts today about fasting and what the Bible teaches us about fasting to ask the question, what is fasting? What is this all about? And I want to begin by looking at some of the famous voices on fasting, people who've written about this and have made significant statements that have carried weight over time. St. Augustine reminded his readers why they should fast. He said, "Because it is sometimes necessary to check the delight of the flesh in respect to licit pleasures in order to keep it from yielding to illicit joys." So for Augustine, fasting was about moral improvement and sanctification. John Calvin supplements Augustine. He says, whenever men, or women, he didn't use women, whenever men are to pray to God concerning any great matter, notice it's connected here to prayer, it would be expedient to appoint fasting along with prayer. Their sole purpose in this kind of fasting is to render themselves more eager and unencumbered for prayer itself. With a full stomach, he says, our mind is not so lifted up to God. For him, then, fasting is in part about spiritual preparation for prayer. My favorite Roman Catholic writer on fasting has a name I can barely pronounce, Adalbert de Vogue, V-O-G-U-E. You can go for it. Vogue, is that it? Who wrote a book called To Love Fasting. Now, this is a theologian's delight. His practice as a priest, as a monk, was to fast daily with one meal each day. And it was in a monastery in a private hermitage. Fasting, he said, was no longer for him a constraint and a penance, but a joy and a need for my body and soul. I practiced it spontaneously because I loved it. De Vogue. For fasting for him was a daily spiritual rhythm. Most people aren't monks that they can live like this. John Piper has observed that the saints of the church were fasters. And then he makes this observation. They were hungry enough for God's leading that they wanted to say it with the hunger of their bodies and not just the hunger of their hearts. So for John Piper, fasting is about spiritual depth. I find these words about fasting generally wise. Pretty good. Who wants to disagree with Augustine, Calvin, and Piper in the same moment? I'll do my best. Put in the simplest of terms, many talk about fasting as something we do in order to get something from God. So we fast because we want something. We want moral transformation, which is a good thing. We want success in our prayer life. We want daily rhythm. We want spiritual depth. So let's fast, and maybe we'll get it. Which leads me to say that fasting, in these cases, is about desire. It's about desire. We make fasting something that physically expresses our spiritual desire. We embody our desire for something by turning desire into fasting, into self-denial. So, as a professor, I now want to become a teacher, all right? And I don't know how this will work, but A is the situation. B is fasting. C is the desire. Most people's understanding of fasting is B, looking at C. The Bible's understanding of fasting is B, looking at A. Whether you get C or not is not the point. There is almost no instance in the Bible of an individual fasting for individual benefits. So we want to turn the focus away from spiritual formation, which is a good thing, toward what fasting is talked about in the Bible. I call fasting, looking in this direction, instrumental fasting. Fasting becomes an instrument, a mechanic that we use to demonstrate to God how serious we are about something, hoping that God will see our intensity. This is what Calvin is talking about, so that we will be given intimacy with God, or let's see, answers to the prayers that we want, or longings fulfilled. If you fast, you will find deeper spiritual formation, is this idea. If you will fast, you will be more safe in your travels. You will find sexual urges diminished. You will discover a more profound hope for your life. You will get answers to your prayer requests by ramping up your prayers with fasting. You will lose weight, which has nothing whatsoever to do with fasting in the Bible. And you will be more healthy, which is the same thing. I call this list of benefits benefititis. It's a medical diagnosis. That itis, I think, means inflammation. Is that right, doctor? So this is an inflammation of benefits that get accrued to fasting. But in the Bible, that's not the focus. It's not over here. It's over here. So you ask, what's over here? We're getting there. Fasting in the Bible did not connect fasting to desire. Bible connects fasting to grief. So now the sermon turns dark. No more fun, folks. Fasting is about grieving grievous situations in the Bible. People saw something deathly. They saw sin. They saw the judgment of God, and they fasted. Not so God wouldn't do it, but because they entered into God's perspective on what they were facing. So the Bible teaches that fasting is about grief. Let me define fasting, just in case it's not clear. Fasting is intentional abstinence from food for a designated period in order to respond to a grievous situation. It is intentional abstinence from food. Right? Morning in the typical fast in Judaism was breakfast and lunch, and then they would eat at dinner. That would be a day's fasting, sort of like Adalbert de Vogue. It is an intentional response of not eating for a designated you say it's going to be for 2 days, and then it is a response to something grievous, a difficult situation. Fasting is not dieting in the Bible. It's not connected to dieting at all. Furthermore, we should avoid the heroic. I have had friends who've fasted for 40 days, and they said they had amazing spiritual experiences. And I said to them, cheekily, that's called chemical reactions in the brain, I believe. I'm not sure that this is really good for your body. Your body begins to go against itself in some way. So I would say, see a doctor if you want to do something heroic about fasting. Fasting in the Bible is not heroic other than Moses and Jesus, and we're not Moses or Jesus. So let's stick with the ordinary. And it was usually a day, a breakfast and lunch. To show the connections between fasting and grief, I asked out of all routines for two passages in the Gospels to be printed in your order of worship. And if you will look at Mark chapter 2, verse 19, you will see this. Jesus answered, "How can the guests of the bridegroom fast while he is with them?" All right, now, you may know that Mark, I know this because I'm a professor, okay. Mark wrote the gospel first, and then Matthew plagiarized. He copied from Matthew and updated it and expanded it. And some of his updatings are revisions and modifications and using of different words to make things clear. So look what Matthew does in verse 15. How can the guests of the bridegroom mourn, grieve? This is a typical Greek word for grieving. So he changes fasting to grieving, because that's what fasting is in the Jewish world. It is grieving. It's not hopeful. It's sad. It's looking at something bad and facing it and grieving over that. But Matthew slips. He doesn't keep it. The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. Then they will fast. He's copying. He didn't bother changing that one to mourn. But this is how we often understand the meanings of words among Jews. Is they use a word, and then they'll use another word like it. And we begin to pick up connections and resonances of Greek words. The Greek word fasting in the Jewish world will always mean grieving, mourning. The rock, you know, so Mark says, I think Matthew says to Mark, you say fast, I say grieve, and everybody will get the idea. So he clarifies what this word means. The rock bottom idea of fasting in the Bible is to grieve. It is grieving people fast. And this is common. When someone dies, people don't say, let's eat. They say, let's not eat. It seems sacrilegious to indulge when people are grieving. That's the core idea of fasting in the Bible. The problem is it's St. Patrick's Day. This is not the best of days to talk about fasting and grieving. So we'll start tomorrow. If you look at the text that we looked at today, you will see the confession of Psalm 51 does not mention fasting. You will see that fasting also is a corporate experience or a group activity, not an individual activity. Who in this Bible passage fasts? Israel, the church, John's disciples, the Pharisees, and eventually Jesus' disciples. It's not so much an individual thing as it is a group thing. It's something we do together to express our grief together. So it is fundamentally a corporate act, not a private act. And in the Bible, it is almost never, I'd like to say it never is, but I'm not absolutely certain. It almost is never an individual act. The big event for fasting is the Day of Atonement. On the Day of Atonement, no one went to local towns and said to people, if you sinned this year, come to Jerusalem. They said, come to Jerusalem because we sinned. Everybody confesses because everybody is involved in the sin of Israel. And that is why in the Bible, confession and fasting are always corporate acts that express complicity of all people in whatever happens. So these words, corporate and complicity, are very much involved with fasting in the Bible. The people of God behaved together when they realized that the people of God had sinned, when God had struck judgment on the people. It is about abstinence in part, not so that people will lose weight. It is about abstinence because people are so grievous about what has occurred among the people. So I want to finish today. This is going to take a little bit, so it's a Baptist finishing. Quietly, prayerfully, soulfully, our complicity in our nations, in our worlds, in our states, and in our churches' sins and systemic corruptions. I'll begin with materialism, with American affluence. Don't laugh about this. 75% of American garages have no cars in them because a car won't fit, while 90% of American garages are consumed by stuff, and the measurement is between 300 and 650 boxes of stuff. American homes are saturated with possessions. I read a book recently on Americans' possessions. It's embarrassing. If we turn this around with our garages, not mine, ours, between 12 and 20% of Americans live below the line of poverty, not having what they need, and Christians don't generally care. The national average of giving is less than 4% of their income. Every 3.5 seconds, someone in the world dies of starvation, and yet there is plenty of food for everyone. The World Bank defines absolute poverty as those living on less than $1 a day, and moderate poverty as those living on less than $2 a day. In 2001, so just 10 years ago, it's not any better, 1.1 billion people were living on less than $1 a day in our world, while our garages are stuffed and our refrigerators are as well. That's something to grieve about. This is why we have Lent. We can grieve as people, as Christians, representing our nation and its affluence before God. We are complicit in relational dysfunctions in our society. We live in a country and a church filled with relational dysfunctions. 50% of marriages end in divorce, and the divorce rate for Christians is not distinguishable from non-Christians. Women are far more likely to experience physical abuse in traditional marriages, Christian or not. We can grieve over relational dysfunctions in our society and in our country. We can grieve over our complicity in racism. Racism, in spite of gains, is not likely to go away anytime soon. 11% of Roman Catholics and non-evangelical Christians object to having black neighbors, because they're black. That number rose with other groups. Mainline Protestants are at 16%. Baptists and evangelicals are 17%. And Southern Baptists are 20%. We are complicit in racism in our country. This is Lent. We can grieve over racism in our country. We grieve as priests for the people of God representing our nation and grieve over our racism. We can grieve over a number of crimes in our country. Most of us would say two things: that crimes are generated by poverty and suffering, and yet those who commit crimes have committed something that is unacceptable. In 2017, in Illinois, there were 997 murders, 5,556 rapes in our state in 2017, 17,567 robberies, and 32,000 physical assaults reported to our police. We can grieve over crimes in our country. This is Lent. It is a time to grieve over what our people are like, what our state is like. We could spread our net wide. What about crime in Rwanda, a country that we care about, where it is even possible to call genocide a crime? What about Darfur? What about Johannesburg, South Africa, and the crime rate? What about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? What about North Korea? Things to grieve about during Lent. I grieve about the amount of plastic produced in the United States that is non-biodegradable, that is now spinning in circles in the Indian Ocean in ways that are disgusting. I grieve over churches in the last year that have done bad things, destroying the reputation of the church and the gospel and ministers. We can grieve. It's Lent. We don't have to worry about spiritual formation. We have plenty of things to worry about, because we grieve as a people complicit in what's going on. Lent is about fasting. Fasting is about grieving. That's the only two things I've said today. There is much to grieve, and when we turn to confession, in just a few minutes, we can confess the sins of our people. We can confess the sins of our state, our nation, and our world. And that's why we have Lent at this time, as we anticipate the cross and the resurrection. But before then, we grieve over the condition of our world.